The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition. Where on today's show, we're not going to so much educate you necessarily, but we're going to get a recap of Jim's recent trip or visit to the AICPA conference in Las Vegas. He's overheard a few new things, I guess, about retirement planning, and he's going to share those
musings,
thoughts,
as I call them.
Those
thoughts.
Musings.
Musings. Or, there's some heavy hitters there, some very people that make you and I look dumb.
Yeah, that's not
too hard. Which is not
too hard
to do, exactly.
So the show, you know, usually we do an educational topic, and what this really is, the EDU show is really everything that's not a Q&A show is kind of what it's becoming, which I guess is okay. So
well,
we're not answering questions on here.
But. Sometimes it is a Q that becomes a very long A, so I do it on the EDU show.
Well, I guess that's true.
We've done Qs before on the EDU show. But this, what I wanted to do, because I attended Sunday afternoon, all day Monday, all day Tuesday, all day Wednesday. Three and a half days. Yeah, it's a hell of a lot of classes. Because I figure if I'm going to drop the kind of bank I drop to go there, it is not a cheap conference.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. Between the conference, the cost of the conference. And it's funny. I told you Ed Slott was there as a student, you know, learning. Mm-hmm. He just kept remarking to me, my food, meaning his class, my food is better, he kept saying. For the price we paid, the food wasn't that great. Mm. But of course, I felt like saying, Ed, there's 400 people when in our class with you. There's 4,500 here.
Right.
There's a hell of a lot more meals they've got to make. So with Ed, it's unlimited. You go up as often as you want. There, here's your meal.
In a box.
It was. It was in a box.
Yeah. That's the big deal at those conferences now.
It's all boxed.
It's all pre-made in a box. And some of it's decent, but it's in a box.
And one thing I will say, it was so... One of the days, they must have been learning how to do this. I don't know. You had to stand in one line to get a ticket to go stand in another line to hand that ticket to someone to get your boxed lunch. It just seemed to be a waste there. You could have accomplished both in a line.
Right.
Because to get the boxed lunch, you had to show them you had registered. So I had to hold up my iPad to show them the app. Okay, you're registered. Here's a ticket. Then I had to go wait in another line to hand someone the ticket. Hmm. It just, that wasn't very efficient.
Seems like some improvement possibilities there.
Granted, these are CPAs, but...
Well, they didn't design that part. They're not running that part.
Wasn't very efficient there. But
speaking of CPA, well, share with everyone what AICPA stands for.
The Association of International Certified
Professional
Accountants.
Right.
I always thought it was public accountants because that's what CPA stands for.
CPA stands for that. They just happen to use, but CPA is a U.S. designation.
Right, that's what I found out, and this is international.
Yeah, right.
In fact, I met people from Australia, New Zealand, and England.
Mm, very nice.
Yes, the English woman was very, very nice. Wicked pretty. Mm. I'll go out and say that. Very married, but very, very attractive. So I didn't meet any non-English-speaking people. And I said, you guys fly all the way out from these countries just for this? Seriously, I'm complaining because I had to fly an hour and a half from Denver.
Yeah.
You're coming all the way over. But apparently any excuse to come to Vegas carried some serious weight with them.
Yeah. So what are the any particular topics?
No. What I did is I attended a bunch of classes, and they give you an app for everything. Mm-hmm. So I fervently typed notes of just kind of the musings that they're teaching us and some of the things that I agree with and I also disagree with. And I disagree with a couple of very, very big wigs. We might as well start with one of the disagreement ones. And it's with Michael Kitsis. And far be it from me to, God, that guy forgets more in a day than I'll ever know. I respect Kitsis immensely. But I disagree with one of the things he taught in a Roth conversion class. And in his class, he got to the topic during the because it was a, this was more of a basic class, I will say that. I told you some advanced classes I went to that it's just, oh my God. There was one class I went to that was for people with a net worth of $40 million or more. And I just thought, I wonder what they teach in these classes. So I went to that one. And I just sat there totally confused, totally lost on most of the things they're saying. I could pick up certain items. Okay, I've heard of that before. I will say it was a very dry presentation. They talked very monotone and just went through and showed all these. Kind of reminded me of that Ferris Bueller. Who's that guy who played Bueller? That economist guy?
Yeah, it's Stein is his last name. It's
Ben Stein. They reminded me of Ben Stein-like economist, wicked smart, but just talk in a very monotone way. But Kitsis isn't. Kitsis is not an economist. He's just smart, and he gives a very compelling presentation. So I went to his Roth conversion presentation. None of it was over my head. I understood everything. And he got on the subject of the backdoor Roth. This was one of the topics he talked about. And in Michael Kitsis' opinion, step doctrine applies.
Which was an argument to either not do backdoor Roth conversions in the first place because you would violate a rule with the IRS that says that if you're not able to do something directly, you're not allowed to take a series of steps that accomplish the same thing. Even if those seemingly are allowed. They call it the step doctrine. If you can, through a series of steps, end up in the same place that normally you would have not been allowed to go directly, you're in violation of the step doctrine, and they say you can't do that. You can't find a way around the rules, essentially, is the deal. So the argument for a long time was always on Roth, backdoor Roth conversions, which was to say, for people who aren't able to directly contribute to a Roth IRA because they make too much money, could they instead contribute money to a traditional IRA where there isn't the income limit and then immediately convert it to the Roth IRA, thus going in the back door? And these backdoor contributions, there was always this concern that the IRS would say, nope, that's a series of steps that accomplishes the same thing that you're not allowed to do, so you're not allowed to do that. And we believe that that's been put to rest
by not
Congress
only
itself and
Ed
the
Slott
IRS.
Was there and Ed disagrees with him. Neither I or Ed disagreed with Mike publicly in that room. But I even said to Ed after, and he shook his head. He's like, no, I don't. No, not at all. And I will share with you something in a second, too, that happened as a result of that class. But you are correct. And we just spoke about it because it's my belief. It's not only mine because Ed Slott believes this. It's mine because Chris and I are two intelligent people. We as smart as Kitsis, we joke. No, Mike is a really smart guy. But we simply look at the IRS. Now, granted, Mike's opinion is that guy from the IRS, I can't remember his name. We spoke about him, and I gave his name on a previous show. He is not, it was not
it wasn't
a revenue ruling.
It wasn't an official statement.
It wasn't an official statement. He was just speaking on behalf of the IRS, and Mike's opinion is, until that comes out as a revenue ruling or some other procedure that he called it that applies, that has weight to it, he's not buying into it. It's just a guy from the IRS. What he didn't mention is the Tax Cut and Job
Act
that specifically addressed this and said it was okay. That carries a lot more weight. That was called the Congressional something that interprets the Tax Cut and Job Act that specifically sanctions.
Yep.
I concede with him, the spokesman from the IRS did not issue a revenue ruling or that other word of what the IRS can rule and say, hey, mm-hmm. this is our opinion. It wasn't. It was more of an interview. And the guy was just saying it is our opinion based on this, that this can be done, no problem.
Right. It was that, that they also admitted that they just didn't like the name of it.
Exactly.
They didn't like the word backdoor
right.
Roth
it sounded
contribution.
Nefarious.
Exactly. So if it had just been named something kinder,
they would have been okay with it.
They would have always been okay with it is kind of what he implied.
So during that presentation from Mike, and again, I highly doubt Mike is listening to this. I've met him twice. It's funny, each time we argued, but I met him twice. We didn't argue. We had a discussion on our fee structure. He is dead against. I shared that with you. He thinks we charge way too little. And when he found out what we charged, he voiced his opinion that we're not charging enough. So I guess people out there who are thinking of maybe hiring us, you might want to take Mike's opinion to granted before Mike and Chris went out and I raised my prices. But he just thinks we charge. I know you agree with him on that.
It's gotten better.
Oh, okay. So thank you.
Still room to go.
But no, the few times that I met Mike and talked to him professionally, we got on the subject of our business models. And when I shared with him my business model and what I charge, he was like, you're nuts. You don't charge enough. That was his opinion. But during that presentation that Mike gave, and I did not have a chance to go up and talk to him after, another person was there. I don't want to say who this person is, but he's very, very close to Mike, and he's actually a really good friend of mine as well. And he's as smart as Mike. In fact, he knows more about IRAs, I feel, than Mike even does. And he produces for Mike and has written for him. Anyways, he was there. After the presentation, I bumped into him. In the for dinner, they had a buffet and free liquor. So of course they're trying to get people in to the place where all the booths the
convention center.
Mm-hmm. And you could go in there and go talk to people at mm-hmm. booths and eat and drink for free. Well, I bumped into our mutual friend, mm-hmm. and I said to him, I says, hey, let's say his name is George. I says, hey George, were you at Mike's Roth presentation today? He says, yeah, absolutely, I was there. I said, what the hell is up with the step doctrine rule? Why doesn't he believe in it? This person threw his hands up and said, this is the one thing he and I are constantly disagreeing on. And he said flat out, I don't agree with Mike on this at all. But for some reason, Mike is fixated on this being a step doctrine issue. And Mike claimed that before, granted, it was before the Tax Cut and Job Act, right. and before the IRS guy came out and said what he said, mm-hmm. that Mike knew of two clients. I don't know if they were his or...
I don't think he has his own clients.
Okay, then they must have been...
It's one of these, he heard about it from somewhere.
Someone to someone.
Yeah.
Who that allegedly these people were being audited... Not for the back door, for other reasons. And the auditors saw that they did the back door and informed the people, we, meaning the auditors, don't like that.
Didn't say you must do
okay,
this.
Okay, you don't
a penalty.
Like it? Sorry.
Yeah, he was kind of, sounds like they were trying to say the same thing as that other IRS person we reference that said the IRS just doesn't like the name, doesn't like the backdoor Roth as a label on it.
Well, so. He said both those people who the IRS auditors said, we don't like mm-hmm. what you did, they both just, I guess I used the word panic, but I don't know if they panicked. They both recharacterized the mm-hmm. money back to the IRA. They didn't let the audit even finish. They didn't get through to mm-hmm. find the findings. They just recharacterized it. And put it back in the IRA as if, okay, you don't like it, let's pretend I never did it. I don't think that's reason enough to say the step doctrine is going to apply. Now, if that happened last week, I'd give it a little more weight than several years ago before the Tax Cut and Job Act came out, and which specifically blessed it. And that IRS guy, and I can't remember his name. We did a whole EDU show on Backdoor, and we talked about him before he blessed it. But it didn't. It happened before, not after. And it wasn't a finding of the audit that these people were hauled before. And no one, and Kitsis admitted this, no one has taken it to tax court yet. No one's fought it.
They're not going to have to because this hasn't ever
been
denied.
Not now, but it's never gotten to the level where a judge had to decree yes or no.
Yeah.
So anyways, I just found
I guess you could put that out there. There's a very small chance, in our opinion, that maybe someone like Michael Kitsis is right. He's kind of on an island by himself now, though, because everyone I'm hearing about is talking about it the other way.
It's like questioning God, though. This guy is incredible. It would be like me dying, going to heaven. God tells me the secret of life, and I look at him and say, "Are you sure?" I mean, I had a hard time raising my hand. That's why I did it. You know me. Yeah. Me of all people. Doesn't generally shy away from this. I sat there in that room. Granted, it was about 500 people in the room. I'm like, Jim, just shut up. Just sit here. Shut up. Don't raise your hand. Don't say anything to him because he's going to... Have you ever met him and talked to him?
Sure, just a little bit.
Oh, my Lord.
He can talk about anything just immediately, just off the tip of his tongue.
And it's like verbal judo. He can just make you seem... I saw him arguing once with someone on a point, not me. Uh-huh. He argued with me about my fees. This, I can't remember what it was about. He made this guy look like a bumbling fool. There's no ums in his voice, just... And when he talks, he knows the section and code of the IRC like nothing. He'll say, well, according to section 54H, subchapter P, paragraph G, you're wrong. And you just, So I certainly wasn't going to raise my hand on this. No. Yeah. When I saw a mutual friend, I thought, okay.
That was safer.
I'm going to go to him. Yeah. But even our mutual friend who was, I'll tell you afterwards who it was, very, very knowledgeable man on IRAs, also said, I disagree with Mike on this. Again, but Mike did say, for those who think Mike is saying you can't do it, it's not what he's saying. He said, wait a year before doing the conversion. He said, if you wait a year, you're okay.
Yeah, and the downside of that is now you're going to have growth that could have been tax-free if it had been in the Roth. I mean, assuming you have growth, let me hedge my comment that it could have gone down as well. But the risk is if you have growth, now it's got to come out and be taxed to do the conversion. Whereas if you had immediately converted it, which is the typical technique, especially now that we believe that the step doctrine is no longer a worry, that all that potential growth would be in the Roth and thus tax-free. So if you're wondering, well, what's the big deal? I don't mind waiting a year. That's the downside.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mike isn't saying don't do it. It's not allowed. Right. He's saying, hey, I think the step doctrine could be an issue. Go ahead and put the money in a non-deductible IRA. Just wait a year and then convert. And he said that's what he would recommend.
Yeah, that'd be super conservative. That'd be super
safe. And our mutual friend worded it exactly that way. Mike takes a conservative approach to the back door. That's what he said.
Ultra conservative, in my opinion. But
Yes. Okay. The next one was Professor Fow, Wade.
Oh,
Wade again.
Well, there's some big hitters at this conference.
There's some pretty big hitters. Who else was there? Fink. You know, F-I-N-K-E. How would you pronounce that?
I would probably say Fink, but is it Finky?
I pronounce it Finky only because you know me and how I butcher the English language.
I would normally say Fink, yeah.
Finka.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
I wouldn't have guessed that either. Hmm. He was introduced as Finka, Michael Finka.
Wow. Learn something new every day.
That's what I said. It should be F-I-N-K-A.
Well, he can spell it however he wants, you know. His family made a decision long ago how to spell the name. Who are you to say it should be different?
Or the person introducing him made a Jimism.
That's possible, but one would think that they check ahead of time.
I know if I was ever introducing someone, I'd be, hey, how do you spell, pronounce your name? Because knowing me, I'll screw it up.
And just hope that the last name isn't abominable.
Oh, God. I will not be introducing you if your last name is that or any of the other words I have a hard time pronouncing. Wade actually did a panel and his own presentation. I'm going to talk about his presentation, and if we have enough time, I'll get into some of his musings from the panel, where he and Mike Kitsis actually slightly disagreed on the 4% rule. But Wade did a presentation on buffer asset. I disagree with the approach he's going, and he was big on those mortgages that we're not supposed to say, only available to people over the age of 62, you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Using those mortgages or proceeds from those mortgages as a buffer asset, what we call bucket two in our bucketing approach. Mm-hmm. He started his presentation, and he did a presentation on the importance of the buffer asset. But the tail end of his presentation was, in his opinion, in addition to using these mortgages or cash, which doesn't yield much, using cash value from life insurance, which I disagree with vehemently. And at lunch that day, I sat at a table of other people who were on the advanced financial planning track like I was, and they were in there. Not anyone was agreeing with his thoughts on that. And maybe I'll explain later why I disagree with him on that. That's not where I'm going to go with this right now. He just presented some really mind-numbing. That's not a good way. Ones that make you think. What's a good word for that?
Mind-expanding.
Mind-expanding. Ways of looking at the 4% rule and why people who just try to plan their retirements on a withdrawal strategy are setting themselves up for failure. That part I really did agree with. How you can fund your buffer asset, the asset that stands between your cash and your investments, we can disagree on if I feel cash value life insurance is a viable alternative for that or not.
Right.
We can
disagree. But the concept of doing it.
But the concept of doing it, I agree with him wholeheartedly. But he started pointing out the risks that people are assuming with the 4% rule. And why don't you just share with people why we don't do that here? Why we don't believe in funding retirements with just withdrawals?
Well, because even though you might make projections, we might make projections with some flat assumed rate of return every year as if that's how investments operate. That's not really how it happens. You're going to have a certain sequence of returns is how we describe it. There's going to be some series of returns over the coming years that no one knows what they are. I don't care who you talk to. If they claim to know, they don't know. If they knew, they wouldn't tell you. So there'll be a series of returns that is going to happen. And depending on those series of returns, the sequence that they happen, what order those returns happen during the time period that you're taking money out to live off in retirement, the sequence itself, beyond just what the numbers turn out to be, but the order in which they happen can have a drastic impact on how your assets either grow or decline over time. And there's a clear area of concern and failure, and that is what percentage of the time do you run out of money because you experienced an unlucky series of returns? And so a lot of people run this special analysis. We call it Monte Carlo analysis. Well, we don't, but I mean, someone else coined that phrase. That is a statistical approach to trying to figure out how likely is it that one of those sequence of returns will occur, causing you to run out of money too soon. And everyone focuses on that and has all this measurement. And they say, oh, you know, if that number is less than 5% or 15% or whatever threshold they've decided is okay, they deem that a successful approach to retirement. Well, my first knee-jerk reaction to that is asking the question, well, what happens in that 5%? And that's important because 5% doesn't sound like a very likely thing happen. You can say, well, I've got a 95% chance of success. Well, that means if you're advising people and you have 100 clients, 5 of them are going to fail. So what about those 5? What are they going to experience if they run out of money? So clearly the question, how bad are things if you run out of money, is pertinent. But the other issue is we also are ignoring in this traditional way of assessing things the other failure. The other failure is you happen to have a very lucky sequence of returns and you end up with a ton of extra money at the end that you could have spent having fun or consuming or doing this, that, or the other thing with instead. So leaving yourself up completely exposed to the sequence of returns exposes you to 2 very significant risks that can be mitigated through a different approach. And there's many different approaches. We have a specific approach where we kind of answer that question directly. What happens if I run out of money? We don't try to say, well, we're going to design something where it's impossible for you to run out of money. Nobody can really do that. But what we answer the question is, what happens if I happen to run out of money? And if you take our approach, if you run out of money, you still have your dignity. You still have your minimum dignity floor. So completely different approach than the withdrawal rate approach for the reasons that I just mentioned.
Well, he gets in also and starts... we have talked on the show previously about the history of the 4% rule, how it came out, how Bill Bengen created it, and all of that. But Professor Pfau also shared with us what he called his he calls himself the retirement researcher. He calls it the retirement researcher manifesto. And it's a couple of things that he believes in and where the 4% rule fails. I'm going to go through his manifesto, but then I'm going to point out to you some facts about the 4% rule now. Remember, this rule is 30 years old.
Right. It was formulated at a time that's a very different time period
exactly.
than we've currently been experiencing.
And I'm going to walk through some of the things he points out of why, if you still don't believe in not funding a retirement, based on his manifesto, here's what he feels a good retirement plan should do and where the 4% rule doesn't do these things. He said, here's the other issues with the 4%. So let me give you a few of his musings from his manifesto. I don't want to get into them all because I don't have much more time on this show. Well, I mean, I'll be on the show for a while, but this show's going to have to wrap up real soon. I like the way he worded this. Was his number one thing. I like the way he worded this. A retirement plan should be based on planning to live, not on planning to die. Mm-hmm. And that's where the 4% rule falls flat, because it was based on living 30 years. And one of the things he pointed out is since the 4% rule came out, life expectancy has expanded 6 years. Since it came out, it's about 2 years every decade. And he said, under the 4% rule, you're planning to die. Mm-hmm. Whereas under our approach, and he doesn't call it our approach, but he believes in ours. It's we're not the only ones who believe in this. He's one who believes in it. It's not a popular approach because investment advisors don't like it. They want to continue to manage your assets at 1.25%, 1.5%. They could give a damn if you run out of money because they're not making you any promises. Yeah. And they just want to keep drawing money.
They'll probably be
retired.
Right,
they'll be retired and gone anyways by then. But they just want to keep managing your money. They don't want you putting it in safe assets or in cash or, God forbid, an income annuity. They don't want to do that. But anyways, I love how he put that, Chris. A retirement plan should be based on planning to live, not planning to die. Under our approach, your minimum dignity floor, which comprises food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. And under transportation, Chris and I put one vehicle. If you have 2, 3, or 4, that's a fun expense that's funded differently. But the maintenance, upkeep, and replacement of one vehicle. So food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, we believe as a firm, those expenses should be covered with lifetime guaranteed secure income, adjusted appropriately for inflation, that lasts as long as you do. So if you live 31 years, 34 years, 35 years, 40 years, and you didn't die when you thought you were going to die, your income continues. I like how he worded that. Mm-hmm. I really do. It's kind of what I say, money left over is life unlived. If you are planning by planning to die, it's what you said. You spend less money earlier in life under the guise you're going to need it later in life. And we often say that's sometimes the wrong approach. If your minimum dignity floor is covered with lifetime guaranteed secure income, Chris and I feel you can spend on your fun spending, which will go through a go-go, slow-go, no-go phase, but you can spend more heavily during the go-go years knowing the older you has their food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care taken care of. But I like how he worded that, Chris. I really do. And he said his number two, do not leave money on the table. We've been saying that forever. That's when we say money left over is life unlived. And under the 4% rule, it's designed to spend just a little every year in case you're around later. Well, dying with money to us is failure, as is dying without money. And we jokingly say the key is to die where the last check you write bounces to the undertaker. But what we truly mean by that is if your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care is taken care of, protected with Social Security, pension, and income annuity, that's one reason Chris and I are very hesitant to tell people to take a lump sum distribution from a from a pension. You know, we had a caller yesterday, a Coffee and Second Opinion caller. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I told you this. Anyways, he's was looking for some advice because he's been offered a pension or a $500,000 lump sum payout from the pension.
Yeah.
He met with a financial, quote unquote, financial advisor who is nothing more than a broker.
Lump sum.
Not only a lump sum, Chris, he told him, take the $500,000, put it in an IRA, and buy this variable annuity from me.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you imagine that? That is everything that's wrong with this industry.
Yeah. Wow, is all I can say.
Yeah.
Thank God he called.
He called because he's an iTunian. He listens, and he said something just didn't seem right with that. You think?
Wow.
Unbelievable. But anyways, Professor Pfau says, do not leave money on the table. And by default, the 4% rule has to leave money on the table because you're taking a little out every year. But it's also based on a 30-year period. So you have two issues here. If you die too soon, you didn't spend enough. Spending only 4% means during the go-go phase, you're living a very constrained phase under the notion that the 90-year-old you is going to spend as much on fun crap as the 60-year-old you. And it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, it's a version of what we call consumption smoothing, where we're assuming that you're going to essentially live the same standard of life, which is interpreted as needing the same amount of money to live on every single year, all the way through your lifespan. Well, that makes sense if you're talking between 30 and 60, maybe. Because you really, you know, maybe you get to the point where you do spend about the same. You live in the same kind of quality of house and drive the same kind of cars and everything is about the same. From 60 to 90, that is a very, very different phase of your life and with major changes going on. As many or more changes as when you went from birth to 30. Right? Birth to 30 is not the same consumption pattern every single year as 60 to 90 is not either. So people, and that's the simplicity of the 4% rule. It assumes that you're going to consume exactly the same every year, which means you're going to travel the same when you're 90 as you are when you're 60.
Which
BS on that.
Which means it constrains your fun spending when you should be spending a lot more than most people do.
Yep.
We had a client pass away not too long ago. Very sad case. Nice man. Nice man. He passed away in his early 70s with seven figures. I couldn't get him to spend. I kept telling him. I don't want to say his name. Let's say it's George. George, spend. I don't know. You know, I should be careful. Sometimes we can't get people over that mental block. But that's what we try to do, is get people to overcome that mental block.
And not just convince them with no backing.
No, there was
backing
here.
Create a situation. No, we're not just simply saying, oh, yeah, you can spend more money than 4%. You know, we're saying put in place a plan so that you can feel better. It's a lot more palatable for yourself emotionally and financially to splurge more, but just splurge in the right ways. Splurge on the things, the fun stuff only, and jeopardize only the fun stuff. Don't splurge on fun stuff to jeopardize the true need, like healthcare. That's the disconnect that most plans have, is they treat them all the same.
Well, what Wade was trying to do there, we beat it a dead horse right there, huh?
We beat it.
Whatever.
We're going to stop beating a dead horse.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was close. I was closer than I usually am.
Mm-hmm.
All right, beat it is not a word. I agree. I like his next two things that he said at his musings. They tie in together. Use reasonable portfolio return expectations. Mm. He talked about stressing. Mm-hmm. Rather, in short, under-promise over return as opposed mm-hmm. to over-promise under return. And that mm-hmm. was his next item.
Yeah.
Be wary of a retirement plan that only succeeds if you have to earn higher than reasonable rates of return. Now, of course, he didn't define reasonable. I think that's going to be up to your advisor, or if you're doing it mm-hmm. yourself, up to you, your risk tolerance, your risk capacity of what reasonable is.
Right. And I think average is too high, if I want to just throw out my own opinion, because average means in the middle, and that implies that you've got just as good a chance of being higher than that or lower than that. And I think you want better than a 50-50 chance in your projection. So we support a rather conservative approach. Not so pessimistic that we assume you're going to keep the money in a box and earn nothing, but certainly not average market returns.
No,
it's
but
too high.
I will say we spend a lot of time, or not you and I personally, Travis mm-hmm. does, the Chartered Financial Analyst who works for us. Travis spends a lot of time projecting our forward-looking return mm-hmm. expectations yep. for five different risk-based portfolios. He uses six different subscription services that provide forward-looking, not backward-looking. Backward looking is asinine. When you get in your car today, folks, or if you're in your car right now driving, answer me this one question. Are you looking through your rearview mirror or your windshield as you drive? If you only look at past performance, you're driving down the road looking in your windshield. Looking in your rearview mirror. What the heck you think is going to happen? So we only look at forward looking return expectations. We subscribe to six different service models. We weight every asset class that we track, and there's either 15 or 18 asset classes Travis tracks. He projects the forward-looking return expectations for all those asset classes, weights them in our allocation models, and determines the weighted average forward-looking return. So he takes six different returns for each asset class, averages them to one return, weights them for all five models, adds it together, and gets the weighted average mm-hmm. return. Okay. So we put a lot of forethought into our number. It's not pie in
right.
the sky.
Mm-hmm.
But we also recognize it's a conservative number. Mm-hmm. There's a lot based on the last 10 years, but you can't look at 10 years of a bull market and say, wow, my portfolio's averaged 9%. If I just project 8, my God, everything is great. It doesn't work that way. And Wade was saying, be careful. Mm-hmm. Be careful of using or basing the success of your plan on needing an unreasonable rate of return. It's just he didn't define reasonability. Okay, before we wrap this up, and then we'll have a musings part two, because I got a lot of other musings I want to get to, I want to point out some unique things about the 4% rule that is giving Wade pause and saying, look, you can't just rely on this like religion, which I thought 2000, 2001, 2002, 2007, and 2008 put that to rest.
No, it's still out there,
but
lingering.
So like, many. Yeah, it's
keeps
like,
turning up like a bad penny.
Yeah, it's like a bad dream that won't go away. And it had its time, it's had its place, but here's a few things. The 4% rule, which says it's actually 4.2 something that he came up with. It was just rounded to 4.
To make a nice round 4, yeah.
The 4% rule does not include taxes or fees. And the last time I looked, you got to pay both of those. And it doesn't account for taxes you have to pay, mm-hmm. nor does it account for fees you're paying. Either, even if you're a do-it-yourselfer, you got some fees you're paying. Granted, they're probably a lot more reasonable than if you're paying some investment advisor, 1.5, 1.25, 1%. Wait till I tell you about an investment RIA person I met. Oh, this is a good muse. I won't do it today. Oh, boy. Wait till I tell you that one, what came up with fees. And another one who doesn't like our fee structure, by the way. But Wade did say it doesn't include taxes or fees. It also looks at only a 30-year period. And as he said, people are living 6 years longer now than when the 4% rule mm-hmm. came out.
On average, which again means, you know.
So if your advisor is basing this off of a Monte Carlo projection that you are going to live 30 years, tell them to increase it to 36 and tell you what the success rate is now. And actually, as Wade said, tell your clients to add 2 years for every decade they expect to live. So if the number today is 36, but your client is 60 and he thinks he'll live to 90, add another 6 to that. Because each decade, people are living about 2 additional years. I thought that was mm-hmm. pretty good. Mm-hmm. He went, and he can do this because he's a number cruncher and he's paid to crunch numbers. He looked and said the 4% rule was based on large cap U.S. stocks and intermediate bonds. He went and looked, I forget at how many individual countries, and used their stock market, and 68% of the time, the 4% rule failed internationally. Mm. And he said the assumption that the U.S. markets will continue and not fall into what the world is falling into is naive. It could happen, but what if it doesn't? Mm-hmm. 68% of the time, the 4% rule failed internationally. I thought that was pretty eye-opening. Mm-hmm. He also said at the period that the 4% rule was based, here was the list from that, interest rates were higher, stock valuations were more reasonable. Today, interest rates are lower and stock valuations are looking stretched. Now, there are some investment advisors who disputed him on that one, but of course, they make their money by telling you to buy more stocks, so they're not going to tell you, yeah, they look a little overvalued. But he was trying to say interest rates have dropped precipitously from 30 years ago. Half the portfolio in the 4% rule, Chris, was bonds. What happens to bonds when interest rates are rising?
They fall in value.
And what happens when interest rates are dropping as they did over that 30-year period?
They go up in value.
Do you think the same is going to happen?
Interest rates are not likely to fall from their current
Well, they have point. Fallen this year and surprised well, a lot of people.
No, a little bit. I mean, but
2.06 on the
10-year.
Going
from 6 to 2 is very different than going from 2 to 1.5,
well,
right?
2.06 right now.
On the 10-year. Crazy. Yeah, on the 10-year.
Crazy.
Yeah.
All those people who thought interest rates were going up, not happening. Okay. That was it. The only other thing I want to throw in. So he gave some interesting. He did believe in having a cash account, a buffer account, and an investment account, much like we do. So that was nice to see someone as smart as Wade supporting that. One thing he did say. The 4% rule was based on the time period 1966 to 1995. The return was 4.2, and it was actually 4.2. And he told me what the other two digits were, but I can't remember, so I only wrote down 4.2. It was 4.2, but it was actually two digits more beyond 4.2. However, if you adjust it for inflation, the return was only 1.3. Another thing to keep in mind. And as he pointed out, taxes and investment fees could easily eat that real return. And now all of a sudden the 4% rule isn't working. The one thing that I did want to throw in there, later on in the afternoon, there was a panel of Fau, Finca, Kitsis, and some other guy. He reminds me of the tenor that no one remembers the name of. The three tenors and the other guy. Remember that from Seinfeld?
Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember who the fourth person was. But Kitsis disagreed with Wade on the 4% rule. Kitsis felt some people, depending on the situation, should use as little as 3 to as much as 6. And wasn't as pessimistic on using a withdrawal strategy as Wade is. Wade is very much in our camp of protecting with lifetime income, certain level of expenses. He doesn't call it minimum dignity floor. He just says you should have a floor, you should have a base. Kitsis is a little more open to an investment approach and said what you really need to do is some people shouldn't be spending 4, they should be spending 3, and others can go as high as 6. So they didn't really get into it. That would have been a nice little smackdown if they could have had that going where they're each talking and giving their facts and figures. They didn't get into that. But I did want to point out Mike was a little bit more receptive to funding a retirement with a withdrawal strategy than we are, where we believe in just protect the minimum dignity floor with lifetime secure income. Then take care of a long-term care. Who's going to take care of you? Do you want to protect yourself for that or not? Then offer any guaranteed inheritances that you may want to leave. Whatever's left over after doing those 3, you and I don't care how fast people spend it down. That's what makes us different. We want people to spend that money during the go-go years as quickly, or not as quickly, but as freely as possible. Remember what my father shared, and I shared it with our listeners a couple of weeks ago. My father told me to tell my clients, he doesn't know about the podcast, well, he knows I have a podcast, he didn't know how to listen to it. He said, tell your client, son, don't be the Debbie Downer. Remember the Debbie Downer? My dad lives in a retirement community, he's 86, everyone there is in their 80s and 90s. They don't do much. But he told me that they do play cards and bingo. And I asked, what do you talk about when you're playing cards? And he says, we talk about all the things we did and what our lives were and what we accomplished, what we did, what we loved to do. He said, but the people we hate, well, he didn't use the word hate in a negative connotation, but the people they don't like talking to the most, he called them Debbie Downers. He said, Jim, those are people with money who can't spend it. They do nothing but complain about everything they should have done. He said, me, I talk about all the things I did do. My dad doesn't have much money now. He lives on Social Security, money that I send him, money that his second wife has amassed. So he doesn't live a wealthy lifestyle. But as he would say to you if he was here, even if I had money, son, I can't spend it. He's a cancer survivor, a heart surgery survivor. He walks with a cane and he can't see at night. He's 86, going to be 87. He said, even if I had money, I couldn't spend it. The most unhappy people in his retirement community, he said, are the people with my health with money. because they can't spend it. And I believe in that, and I share that story. And my father tells me to tell my clients, and I'll pass this on to my iTunians and Androidian podcast listeners, don't be the Debbie Downer. Retirement planning is not about investing. It's about spending. And a wise retirement plan is going to go over what Chris and I believe in. Take care of the older you, their minimum dignity floor. And if you want to leave them any help as they age for people to take care of them, put in a long-term care plan. And if you want to help your younger generation leave a guaranteed inheritance for your children, put in that plan. Once those three are done, however much money is left over, spend it during the go-go phase. Because my dad is in the no-go phase, and he doesn't spend much money anymore. And that's what he wants people to know. You can't look at your retirement through the same eyes. You just used a minute ago, Chris, newborn to age 30. You're now going backwards. You retire almost like a 30-year-old in the sense you're still healthy, hopefully. You've got some money. You've got some desires. You want to do things. But you're going to end almost like a newborn. Potentially totally dependent on others to take care of you. Potentially totally unable to understand what is being said to you. The first 30 years, you're growing and learning. The next 30 years, you're maintaining. But the last 30 years that we're trying to help you with, you're declining. I've got to say that. It's what happens. So you are not going to be spending money in your 80s and 90s like you will in your 60s. And what we're trying to say, under a withdrawal strategy, by default, it constrains you earlier in life under the notion you're going to need this money later in life. It's just creating, Chris, a bunch of Debbie Downers. And instead, what we're trying to do is say, hey, your minimum dignity floor is protected. Here's what you decided to do for your elder assistance, if you want that plan or not. Some people don't. Some people do. Here's what you're going to do for younger generations, guaranteed inheritances to kids and grandkids. The money that's left over, Chris, that's for what? Fund spending.
Yep. What we call your desired spending. And that can be distributed however you want. And it can match more what you can do physically and mentally. More earlier as you're younger and less later when you're older. And if you screw it up, this is what I always point out to people, if you mess that part up, all you're messing up is the fun stuff, right? If you totally overestimate how long things are going to last and you don't manage that part very well, all of your minimum dignity floor is covered.
And your long-term care if you planned right. for that, and your inheritance if you planned for that.
Right. Exactly.
So the worst that happens is you can't do fun things anymore. Oh, horror. You'll be like my dad. My dad blew all his money. He didn't have much. My dad was a dry cleaner. I was a cop before I became a financial planner. But my dad spent all his money and had fun. And he enjoys his life. He's not the Debbie Downer. But as he said, even if I had the money, son, I wouldn't be able to spend it. The Debbie Downers are the people with the money, can't spend it, and as he put, they know or they feel, because they keep saying, these people are just waiting for me to die. They're just waiting for me to die. I never see my kids. I don't see this. They're just waiting for me to die. That's not a wonderful, fun way to spend your last years.
No.
Anyways, that's my musings from the AICPA meeting. I will get into more, especially a very, very eye-opening discussion with a wholesale money manager, in other words, manages money for advisors instead of advisors managing it for clients, when he found out about how we manage money, and when I asked him, if I hired you, not that I was going to, if my firm hired you to manage money for my clients, how can I measure your performance? I'll tell you his insight on that, because there was no way, and how he defended that.
Oh, Interesting.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, I'll as you take off, I know you have to go. I'll remind people that we are living, breathing, practicing financial planners in the Northern Colorado area. We help clients all over the country, though. So if our philosophy of retirement planning seems to fit well with how you might see yourself navigating these retirement waters, we encourage you to reach out to us and let us know that you'd like to have a little chat. We offer a free, what we call a coffee and a second opinion, where we will talk about, describe in even more detail than we do on the podcast, exactly how we approach retirement and what steps we take and how we can put together a plan, answer questions you might have, and figure out if this is what we're offering is something that you can actually benefit from. If you've got issues that we can't help you with, we can certainly help find the right resources for you and direct you in the right way. But please reach out to us. No matter where you are in the country, we can deal with you remotely via the phone, email, and also basically kind of teleconferencing, where through your computer we can share screens and talk to you on the phone and walk you through things just as if you were sitting in front of us at our office. So the best way to contact us is go to jimhelps.com. That's the main website. You can also get there with chrishelps.com. Ends up in the same place, though. And on there's a contact form. You can fill that out, or you can actually schedule that coffee and a second opinion meeting directly. There's a little calendar app on there, and you can schedule it yourself if you know that's what you want to do, even before talking to us. So thanks, everybody, for hanging in with us here on this latest EDU show, and we'll be back with you with another show next week.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.